You mentioned CA-125, and you had a paper last year looking at CA-125 in patients with recurrent ovarian cancer. Can you talk a little bit about that paper, as well as the other point you made about the issue of CA-125 with biologics?
Sure. So patients and doctors know CA-125 well. It's been around since 1981. It's been a staple of our decision-making process, and patients know about it. I think some of the hardest trials to do are ones where we blind patients to their CA-125 reports. They'll just go down the street and get another one from somebody else. It's problematic. But one of the things that came up when I started to look through this literature with a buddy of mine, we noticed that not necessarily all of the chemotherapeutics that we used had the same kind of profile to CA-125. And actually, this idea came from somebody you've interviewed on this program before, Tom Herzog, who's a good friend of mine in New York. And he and one of his fellows got a data set of patients that have been treated with two drugs that are commonly used in ovarian cancer, topotecan and pegylated liposomal or Doxil. And they collected all the CA-125 data, and they wanted to look at it in relation to actual clinical responses, which were achieved and documented by various different parameters. And we got a hold of that data set, and we kind of combed it and realized that there were some differences between those two drugs. So we went back to a data set which was a lot cleaner, and that was the registration trial for pegylated liposomal doxorubicin or Doxil. And in that trial, which was published by Alan Gordon, they collected CA-125 throughout the course of their therapy, but they didn't make any decisions in terms of progression on the basis of just that biomarker. So they required measurable change to document response or progression. So it was kind of a unique little window into the very short period of time during the first two cycles of therapy, for which most of the patients got the intended treatment, and we wanted to look at how CA-125 performed amongst the responders and non-responders in that cohort of patients. So it was a relatively clean set of data. It's limited because it's only for the first couple cycles. After the second cycle, if they progressed, they were moved on. And so we weren't able to collect data on as many people after the third cycle. But for the first two cycles, it did. And so what we saw was that there were a large number of responders who actually had rising CA-125s after they were put on therapy. And I think the concern that was raised is that in the community, as I mentioned earlier, since there's such a reliance or such a crutch on CA-125, is that I was afraid that people were actually abandoning the drugs they were on because of these effects in CA-125 early on in therapy. And so really the point of the article was to say, listen, give it a fair shot, see what happens, and realize that there can be this rise in CA-125 early on in treatment, and to not have a knee-jerk reaction to say, well, the patients are not going to benefit from it.